In partnership with the Lilly Fellows Program, the Institute of Communication and Religion at Seton Hall is proud to present a follow-up to Communication and Religion in the 2020 Election Conference. Join four of the speakers as they discuss what happened in the 2020 election and what these events say about the future in communication and religion.
Hello, everyone. My name is Joaquin Matamis, and I am an alumnus of Seton Hall University. On behalf of the College of Communication and Religion, I'm here with Dr. Robert Polito to follow up on last year's talk on the limits of ideology in the 2020 election. Now, Dr. Polito is a former public interest lawyer, having been involved in New Jersey cases on public entitlement and housing rights. He is also a professor in the Department of Political Science and Public Affairs in the College of Arts and Sciences at Seton Hall University. And his research focuses on different topics such as civil liberties, executive power, and constitutional power, as well as critical theory and contemporary political thought. He's also a published author whose works include Presidential Secrecy and the Law, Torture and State Violence in the U.S., and In the Shadow of the Great Charter. And most recently, he also wrote Bargaining with the Machine, which examines the intersection of personal liberties and the ubiquity of technology. Dr. Polito, thank you for coming onto the show.
Thanks for having me.
As I mentioned before, we're kind of following up on the last talk. We were talking about kind of the role of ideology in how it motivates voters, how basically the intersection of religious belief and political power. And I guess I was most interested in seeing how that played a role this time around in the election results. So just out of curiosity, off the top of your head, from what you've seen with the results, what are your thoughts about how...
You know, the timing is interesting, Joaquin, because when I gave the talk, I believe it was late October of 2020, just before the presidential election. And I was kind of speculating about what the results might be. And now we know what the results are, although not everyone in the United States agrees with what they are. But, you know, we have a year of hindsight. And so some of the things that we expected and predicted came true. Others were a little bit surprising. I don't think people expected the levels of turnout that we got in the presidential election. I think it was a 66% turnout of eligible voters. And so both candidates got more votes than anyone in history because of that in the presidential election, because of that high turnout. So one of the things that was not surprising is that white evangelicals, whether they attend religious services regularly or not, voted overwhelmingly for Trump, somewhere between 70% and 80%. But obviously the result was different in the election. Trump lost. And one of the explanations for that was that independent voters and suburban voters turned out more for Joe Biden than they did for Hillary Clinton. So, you know, that's kind of the short story of the election results. Of course, there's a lot more to it. The results were disputed hotly, as everybody in the United States knows. We should talk about why the white evangelical support remained so strong, and also why that wasn't enough to carry Trump over the top.
Despite the strong support, you know, Biden in the end won. Are there any ideological explanations as to why there was such a high turnout this time around, or, you know, why there were more independents or involved in this election?
It was kind of paradoxical because there was a significant amount of negative sentiment about both candidates, and the negative sentiment kind of drove the voting patterns more than positive, I think. It's not that Joe Biden was beloved by a vast share of the electorate, but more that I think a lot of voters were afraid of four more years of Donald Trump. At least that's what some of the polls beforehand indicated. You know, how enthusiastic are you about Biden? How will you vote? Putting those two things together. So I think that the other thing that happened was that voting was in some ways easier. And now we're hearing these sort of rumblings about how we need to make voting more difficult at the level of state laws and also preventing federal laws that would improve access even further because of the sort of specter of voter fraud, which I think is a transparent statement about the Republicans not wanting a large turnout. Large turnout hurts them historically. But so there was a bigger turnout this time, and I think part of it was because of the intensity of negative feelings about Joe Biden. And then part of it was because of the pandemic, people were able to vote early, vote remotely. I actually had a sort of a bird's eye view. I went with a friend of mine to do in Philadelphia, and there was sort of a constant stream of people coming in. And these were just people who were voting in person on election day, but talking to some of the other officials there, there was a lot of voting had already happened. So, I mean, I could sort of see that this was a busy day at the polls, but on top of all the voting that already happened in that precinct, and it was a small enough precinct in this little neighborhood in Philadelphia that they could say how many voters they expected. And they knew that many of them had already voted.
So would you say that it was less of a political grasp that these two candidates had, you know, on voters, and more it was just kind of a fear of like the lesser of evils in the sense?
This is a risky way to explain things anecdotally, but there was something that Angela Davis, the scholar and activist, said about the election. I mean, she's well known as a left critic of U.S. policy and of the dynamics of race in the United States. And yet she came out publicly to say, look, Joe Biden is not my ideal candidate, but for me, the choice is pretty clear. That, you know, we're moving very quickly towards fascism, you know, if we have another 4 years with Donald Trump. And I think that was the feeling of a lot of people. It was this kind of fear, you know, of what we'd already seen, sort of, you know, breaking all limits of presidential behavior and both legal norms and sort of norms of the office, norms of the institution. And so that warning came from sort of all across the political spectrum. And I thought it was striking that Angela Davis made a statement of Biden, because she's not someone who's typically going to campaign for a centrist candidate in an election. That story was very revealing to me. And I think it also reflected the way a lot of people felt from center to left, and maybe even, you know, a little bit right of center. We know that there was some denunciation of Trump's behavior after the election from the center right, and that kind of evaporated when the Republicans closed ranks behind him after the second impeachment. But I do think that there were some people who said enough. You know, the spectacle of seeing people violently invading the Capitol was kind of a bridge too far.
I remember you said something along the lines of like 80% of white evangelicals are Republican. And as you said, like a majority of them voted for Trump. So there's obviously like this very clear following that, that, you know, that Trump is mobilized to, you know, through these evangelicals. So why didn't it work this time around? Why did Trump essentially fail in his campaign, and why did Biden succeed?
So the Pew Research Center did a number of after the election polls, and they came up with the numbers, and the numbers were specifically white evangelicals who attend religious services regularly voted 71% for Trump and 27% for Biden. And then among infrequent white evangelical Protestant, infrequent church attenders among that same demographic, I think the number was even higher. I think it was closer to 80%. So that was the statistic that I cited. So the question is, why wasn't that enough to put Trump over the top? Well, because there aren't enough. I mean, the numbers don't add up. So there aren't enough people in that demographic, even though it went so heavily for him. He needed independents and he needed suburban voters. And of course, these categories overlap. You can be a suburban voter and also white evangelical. So, you know, it gets tricky, you know, trying to spin these things out when the categories might overlap. But it was the support that he lost. Hillary Clinton was extremely unpopular with a lot of people. And so Biden performed better with those other two groups. And that's what allowed him to win. So the phenomenon, I guess, and you know, looking ahead, if he should decide to run again in 2024, he's going to have the votes that he had before and then some. Or there are going to have to be barriers to ballot access that take away some of the votes that Biden got this time. And I think that's what a lot of people are worried about, because the math is, right, he didn't have enough votes to win. He's probably not going to get more votes. So the only way he can win again in the future is to take away some of the votes that the other side has. And I think that's why you see the closing ranks behind him, and you see the, you know, this sort of intensive efforts to beat back progressive voter reform and to institute, I would say, repressive and racially discriminatory voter reform. But on the ideology question, it's such a paradox, because I mean, I've been interested all the way back from when I did my dissertation. I've been interested in ideology theory sort of as a body of thought, and you know, how effective is it in explaining some of the things, you know, that we see in this country, in the world. And it's so challenging, because as one Michael Rosen, the great political philosopher, said at a conference once when I was attending, he said, there's a lot of loopy stuff out there. So there's this brilliant, you know, theorist using the vernacular just to say there's so much that we have to explain. I mean, if you look at some of the photographs from the January 6th insurrection, I mean, there are people kneeling in front of a cross and praying in front of the White House. So the links are definitely there between people who think that there's sort of a God-given mission of supporting Trump, you know, and Trump's very self-serving kind of efforts to get the election result overturned. So it's there, and it seems crazy. But the problem, I mean, to me, as a scholar, this is an interesting problem. But as a person living in this country, it's a frustrating problem, too. How do you tell somebody that their considered belief is wrong? Whether it comes to vaccines, whether it comes to what the Bible says, you know, what the Bible tells them they should be doing. There's a joke. This is an academic joke, so it's not funny. I have a theory. You have an opinion. She has an ideology. And so the joke, I mean, it's so bad you have to explain it. So the joke is that what the other person believes is less creditable than what you believe. It's less thought out. It's less defensible. And so the other way to put the joke is, well, my theory of justice is correct. How come other people won't believe me? And so you can sort of apply this to the phenomenon of the religious right sort of dovetailing with other groups that fuel the protest. And, you know, these are things that either they say they sincerely believe, or at the very least, they're able to spin out a justification for what they're doing. So it raises one of these problems of ideology theory, which is, you know, what's the outside? How do you, Joaquin, stand outside and say, okay, Pulido, you're under an ideological delusion. I see things clearly in the political world, and I need to show them to you. Because, of course, I'm going to say, no, you're inside of it too. Or, you know, and I'm seeing it from outside. So then you have to get into some of these kind of technical questions in political philosophy, like, and specifically with ideology theory, like, you know, do beliefs have to be false? Can they be false? Another to call them ideological. So, you know, values, for example, can't be true or false. If I tell you that I think that, you know, filial piety is very important, you might say, well, it's not important to me, but you can't say that's a false belief, right? It's a value. Or if I say hard work is ennobling. So you may disagree with me. You may say, well, that was used as a motto in the Nazi death camps, you know, which it was, right? But that doesn't make it true or false. It simply is a statement of values. And so the problem is that so many things that people espouse are not about facts. And then so you can't critique them ideologically. And there can even be true beliefs. So for example, right after 9/11, there was a sort of panic in the country about the next terrorist attack. And so people like Dick Cheney sort of exploited that fear and said, because the next smoking gun could be a mushroom cloud, we need to reform all of these laws, giving the government greater power to search secretly, hold people without charges, all the to torture people, basically. And so what he was saying was true. There was a risk of another terrorist attack, right? So the statement wasn't false, but it was used for a political end. So all of this makes it very tricky to talk about this thing that we know is out there in a kind of systemic way, you know, and to say that ideology functions as a system to affect power relations. I mean, this is all getting very heavy, but you see the problem that we see this craziness around us, and we're trying to get a grasp on how do we account for it in discourse. So, I mean, you and I might say, well, yeah, and presuming here, I think that people should get vaccinated. I think COVID is real, right? And so how do we respond to people who say, no, it's really about freedom? And so it has a practical aspect, and it also has this theoretical aspect that are both challenging.
You know, from my little like micro perspective, I'm thinking, oh, you know, maybe it's religion that's the big thing. I mean, one of the, depending on who you are, of course, either less or more exciting things was that Joe Biden is our, you know, second Catholic president in U.S. history. Wow. And a lot of people were likening, you know, this to almost like a JFK level of like, you know, oh, it's like a, you know, Catholic resurgence in a way. But most interestingly, like JFK was very popular. He almost got like 3/4 of the Catholic vote. But I mean, I think this time around, it's only around 52% that actually voted for Biden. And, you know, we keep talking about white evangelicals, you know, and how they kind of like make up the majority of support for Trump. I thought it would have been like, you know, an issue of possibly like, you know, religious ideology that's taking root in these elections. But I guess, does it go beyond that? Or does religion still have like sway when it comes to political power?
you know, Biden is in this tricky position because, you know, his public statements about reproductive rights are sometimes at odds with the Catholic Church, and he doesn't emphasize this as a member of the Democratic Party, you know, as a progressive person. I mean, that's where he is. And so it creates a challenge. I don't want to say a challenge, that's the wrong word, but, you know, it creates an opportunity for common ground among different faith-based groups who oppose abortion and who oppose reproductive rights for women. And so, you know, that has just become and has remained ever since Roe versus Wade was decided, such a bright dividing line, so that I've known people who were really committed to the social justice aspect of the Catholic tradition, and were also really committed to going to pro-life marches. You know, so they would go to impoverished communities, you know, around the world and work to eradicate poverty and to promote human rights. And they would also be marching the next week, you know, in a pro-life rally. So it's the issue, it drives such a wedge. And this is not news to anybody, but I mean, it gets to exactly what I think this whole project is about, which are the intersections of religion and politics. And there's so much that you can say about that. Part of the problem too is, what do people actually believe? So if I answer a survey and say, you know, I attend such and such evangelical church and I go 50 times a year and I am a devout Christian who believes in universal love and so forth, I mean, that certainly is significant, because as the philosopher Slavoj Žižek said, even when people don't take things seriously, they're still doing them. But you don't know what people's ultimate commitment to the choice issue is. For some people, it is extremely important. For others, it's a part of identification. And one of the things I think that scholars, you know, studying this phenomenon have pointed out is that the identification by party is so strong that it will sometimes overcome the identification by faith. So that scholar Shanto Iyengar has written about how their sort of religious background as part of their tradition that was sort of given to them at birth, but their party identification is something they can choose. They'll reject their religious upbringing if it conflicts with what the party is demanding. So then party becomes this incredibly powerful force in American life. And, you know, at the same time, there is this question about the culture war. Mars Fiorina asks whether we actually have a culture war, and he says no, but he says what we do have are these extremely polarized and polarizing parties. So the people themselves are somewhere in the middle on these questions, but it's the parties who are driving the extreme views. And, you know, my kind of snotty response to that is, well, what is the difference in a way? I mean, if the party is demanding that its adherents make certain statements and vote for certain candidates, you know, and in order to be in good standing, or at least that's what they're driving for, then we are polarized. And what does it matter whether we say it's party polarization or electorate polarization?
One of the things that interested me most, especially about starting to talk about the post-election era, was especially the, you know, the January 6th Capitol attacks. I was mostly curious about the role of ideology in how these attacks were mobilized, or, like, you know, but most of all, I guess now it's a question of, like, what power was at play that kind of mobilized these people to do this. And so almost to go back on something you said in your last talk, it was about how we kind of live, well, first of all, we're in a post-ideological time, right? It's this time of questioning, like, you know, norms, and yet having to adhere to these norms. And, you know, that we also live in this ironic age. And I think in many ways, like, that these attacks kind of, you know, capitalized on these issues. So I guess what I'm asking is, you know, what power is at play? And, you know, as citizens, as people, how do we live with the reality that there are so many factors that influence us in life?
First of all, I have to say that as somebody who studies politics and teaches politics and writes about politics, the whole thing was incredible. From the Trump presidency, through the election, through the January 6th. I mean, I can't believe that I'm living through this. You know, think about it. We've never had a president urging a mob to go and storm a Capitol. And to me, there is, whatever you think, whether it was good or bad, I mean, that is what happened. So here's the thing about the, you know, irony and the post-ideological age. So one of the reasons that people talk in those terms is they say, well, it's not possible in a thick, complex society like ours to sort of manipulate the strings of puppets and get people to do your bidding in this sort of organized conspiratorial way. So, you know, when Marx talked about agents of the bourgeoisie, spreading false consciousness, or at least one strand of Marxist theory can support that idea. It sounds silly. It's like, you know, these evil people who are manipulating, you know, the population. And so the question from ideology theory perspective is, who are the agents who accomplish this belief shaping and this manipulation? And it's often hard to answer. But in this case, in the January 6th insurrection, it's not hard to answer. And more information is coming out every day about how media personalities and people associated with Trump and people in the Congress, where it was a very well concentrated effort to do everything from try to, you know, basically seize voting machines to get the message out and rev up a lot of people to come to this event. So on the one hand, you know, this is a horrible event for the country. From an ideology theory perspective, it's a rare opportunity where you see an orchestrated plan come to fruition. Come to DC, it will be wild. You know, people are angry, right? You've basically fed them information to make them angry, and they're angry about the pandemic, you know, they're angry about economic conditions already. You know, they have perceived grievances about injustices in their situations, right? And so you're able to say, well, if we have people in the media like Alex Jones, you know, I'm encouraging people to come out. And if members of the Republican Party are turning out crowds and so forth, they're coming to this election. And if we can say it's a religious duty as well and bring in another segment, you know, of anti-Biden forces, right? And that's what happened. So it was like, here's the plan, and the plan played out. So most of the time we're saying, well, our society is too thick, you know, in social theory terms, to really explain, you know, A to B, like, you know, Pulido was able to lead the country to war by himself, or put this sort of deception over a whole national electorate, right? I mean, it seems it's elusive. You can't come up with a coherent, cogent explanation like that. But here you can. And what's unbelievable is that we had, you know, a president who was willing to do that, you know, and we've had some chief executives, you know, in the White House over the years who've done some pretty terrible things. And we have some really bleak moments in our history. But this one, it was different. It was like, let's organize a crowd to go and attack the Capitol and possibly hang people. For all the difficulties of talking about this in ideological terms, that one is strikingly clear.
A couple final words, because this use of ideology in the most, I guess, poignant sense, it's very powerful, but also very negative, especially in, you know, in the U.S., where we're still even talking about these riots, you know, a year later. Do you have like any sense or any thoughts on any way to mobilize ideology for good? Or do you foresee like a future for the U.S. in a way that ideology can be mobilized for good or for better?
I'm sort of dropping all these names in the conversation, but Antonio Gramsci was an Italian Marxist who died in prison during the run-up to World War II. And his take on ideology is that in a society, you always have sort of a push and pull, that you have two prominent social groups, whether it's workers and bourgeoisie, or whether it's, you know, peasants and landlords, feudal lords. And so the terrain is always unstable. And at any moment, not at any moment, but at particular moments, one group can get the upper hand and shape, you know, the explanation of social reality that becomes accepted. And so for Gramsci, he certainly had his idea about how to use it for good, but he also thought that it was never settled, you know, and some people following him later in the 20th century picked up on this and said, even with language, right, language is always open. You can't say this word will always mean this thing forever. And as a result, you know, the battle, this sort of on this contested terrain, is always going on. The scary thing about that is there are a lot of people who are trying to sort of interject common sense into public opinion and debates and running into a brick wall. Like, you know, why does the public hate Anthony Fauci? Large segments of the public, not everybody, obviously, when he's simply giving his opinion as an expert in infectious disease. Somebody talked about this inside and outside of ideology in the sense of, okay, and this should ring a bell when we were reading David Hume way back when you were an undergraduate. So we're skeptical about, you know, the causes of the things that we see in the world. And yet we accept enough of our experience to go on living. And so the example, this is not my example, I wish it were. We accept enough of physics to turn the light on. So every time you go to the wall and go to flip the light switch, you don't say, well, you know, Hume would say that we don't know what the cause of this light going on might be, so I'm not even going to turn it on, right? We have to go on with our lives. We have to sort of step out of the skepticism a little bit. And so in the life and death time of talking about COVID, you know, there's a question, you know, are vaccines harmful? Are they useless? Are they saving lives? And so, you know, the way many of us made the decision was, okay, let's hear what the experts say. Let's hear what the statistics are. Let's not get caught up in the symbolism of something at the cost of people's lives. And so for a lot of us, I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm not a physician. And yet I was satisfied enough with the information that I got and consumed and processed that I could make decision for myself. And yet we're so split as a country because you hear the other perspective everywhere. I mean, people are dying of the disease and still talking about how, you know, the vaccines are a conspiracy. And I don't understand that. And it's disturbing to me. But, you know, at the same time, you know, we're gonna continue to intervene in debates. And when I say we, I mean, you know, people who are trying to use reason and science and so forth. And there'll come a time when we're past, I think, I hope, you know, this particular virus, because enough people accepted what we were, what we were told by scientists and thought about it and processed it.
Dr. Pleader, I think that's all the time that we have today, but thank you so much for joining us. And I hope you guys tune in next time.
This follow-up to the College of Communication and Religion's 2020 conference is hosted by Jasmine DeLeon and Joaquin Matamas and produced by Kai De Jesus. The college would also like to thank the Lilly Fellows Program for their contributions and you for listening.